Welcome to a special edition of the Roundtable. This is part one of our project, Will We Ever Learn? The Struggle for Equality, One Group at a Time. Partial support for this project comes from Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The Mass Humanities grant is part of their initiative, Crisis, Community, and Civic Culture. American history is punctuated by social, economic, and political crises, giving rise to collective action, sometimes progressive, other times reactionary, sometimes peaceful, and other times violent. Collective action has often led our nation through crisis to a period of recovery and relative stability. With that in mind, we look at why all equality is not created equal. Why do women, blacks, gays, and many other minorities have to go it alone in their fight for equality, when it could come down to the issue of human rights, all being created equal? In this hour, we address the topic of equality. How do we define it? What makes us equal? How does it differ from diversity? To discuss these questions, we welcome two distinguished guests. Alexander Kasar is the Matthew W. Sterling Jr. Professor of History and Social Policy at Harvard University. Professor Kasar, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
A great pleasure to have you with us. Paul Finkelman is a great friend of the show and is the John Hope Franklin Visiting Professor of American Legal History at Duke University and the President William McKinley Distinguished Professor of Law and Public Policy and Senior Fellow at the Government Law Center at Albany Law. Paul, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's a delight to be here, although it's strange to be doing it by phone since I'm usually sitting right across the table from you.
When we made these plans, you were going to be in Albany, but here
I
you
was.
Are at Duke, and I'm delighted that you could still be with us. Before we, a reminder to our listeners, we are going to open up the phones at the bottom of the hour and welcome your calls. Much of the series is to talk about these issues, and we want you to talk about them with us. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. I'll be giving it throughout this half hour, and then we'll be including your phone calls. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. I am interested in starting, and Alexander Kasar, let us begin with you. When it comes to a definition of equality, because As you have pointed out, we have social and economic equality, we have rights equality. So how do we define it?
Well, I think part of the issue, part of the question is that we probably don't have a shared definition in this country in public discourse, and probably different groups have different definitions. I mean, I think that there's certainly a tendency in modern American conversation to think of equality as equality of opportunity, or even to simply mean the absence of formal discriminatory barriers against equality of opportunity. You know, I mean, if we take the election rhetoric from the, if we can still remember back to the recent election, you know, and everyone talking about the American dream. I think, you know, the conception of equality there, I think, every young child, sure, young person should have roughly the same chance to go and live the American dream, what that was. What we tend to avoid talking about is equality of condition, or inequalities of condition. I think, you know, for example, the word inequality was rarely used in the election campaign. And there you can talk about, certainly about economic or income inequalities or equality. You could talk about power, one's ability to influence, say, one's workplace or the circumstances that affects one's life. But I think we can do a lot of different things with defining it. And part of what I would think the public debate should be and that we should be trying to have is trying to figure out what we do mean by it.
And Paul Finkelman, anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, I think the other possibility, of course, is one could argue that there should be some kind of equality of outcome. That is, if you don't have something that resembles much of the time an equal outcome, adjusting for all kinds of things, then you have to think that there's some kind of inequality at the starting point. And I think one of the great problems with American history and our society today is that we don't have real equality of opportunity going in. We don't have equality of conditions going in, and we end up with skewed outcomes at the other end. And this is in a variety of ways. We tend to think of equality when we debate this as the poor or the underclass or minorities, and people say, well, you know, they have equality of opportunity. But we never think of it in the other side, which is the vast inequality of people going in. So, for example, when we think about university admissions and we think about something called affirmative action, whatever that might mean, no one ever talks about affirmative action for very, very rich people whose fathers or grandfathers or great-grandfathers went to the great universities in the United States and therefore get a certain bonus entering college. I mean, without rehashing the last 12 years of politics, I don't think there's anybody in the United States who believes that George W. Bush had the grades or the scores to get to Yale on his own. He got to Yale because his father had gone to Yale, his grandfather, his uncle, and he was what they call a legacy. And so one of the things we need to think about when we think about inequality is that there are all kinds of legacies that help some people and hurt others. The other thing is we should think about how we measure people when we decide to offer them the opportunities or the benefits of our society. What is the measurement? To use another kind of example, is an SAT score of, say, 2,000, which would be the three SAT exams combined, is an SAT score of 2,000 from somebody who went to a very prestigious prep school and got the best possible education, is that as good as somebody who came here as an immigrant and didn't speak English and grew up in a non-English speaking home and got an SAT score of 1,700? You know, one might say that, gee, 1,700 is actually a much better score given the inequality of circumstances all the way up the line. So these are, you know, just some of the issues that as a society we need to sort out.
Alexander Kesar, one of the things that you have written about extensively is voting. You have the book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. How tied is voting and voting rights a barometer in some ways of equality? And I ask this question because you said something to me in an earlier conversation that one of the dirty little secrets is not everybody really believes that everyone else should be allowed to vote.
Right. I think I did say that. I plead guilty. I think that voting rights is something of a, it's something of a barometer. It may be a fairly minimal barometer, but certainly, for most of our history, I mean, despite a mythology that we are the oldest living democracy, and that, you know, people got off the Mayflower and immediately began talking about how can we be democratic, developing institutions that would be more democratic and more equal and that would have, for example, universal suffrage took us hundreds of years. I mean, I've written in various ways that I think you can talk about the United States achieving something approximating universal suffrage by 1970, which is a lot later than the standard mythology. And the inequalities in voting rights were very important. They affected gender, they affected race, there were class biases. For example, that you had to own property or pay taxes. The Supreme Court does not rule out class tests for voting, or that's to say financial requirements, until the 1960s.
That's really with the adoption of a constitutional amendment that prohibits a poll tax in part.
Right. I mean, it's...
And so any tax, any financial barrier to voting is in one sense or another a poll tax.
That's absolutely right. And what's so stunning, I think, for a lot of people, certainly for a lot of my students, is realizing that that doesn't become clearly unconstitutional until the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, I think going back to your question, I mean, certainly our history is filled with inequalities about voting, and they are something of a barometer. Part of the argument put forward about expanding voting rights, for example, part of the argument for expanding voting rights in the 1850s, in the 1950s, before it was also put forward in the 1860s, just after the Civil War, was that without the right to vote, without the political power that comes with that, people would be completely unable to defend their other rights. And without equal political rights, they're completely unable to defend social and economic rights. And I think that there's a great deal of truth to that. To give one historic example, after the Civil War in the South, when for a brief period African-Americans or most African-Americans could vote, and they controlled local and some state governments in the South, one of the things they did was to pass laws and pass taxes to promote very widespread public education, including for African Americans. Literacy was a very big deal. People wanted to learn to read themselves. They wanted to have schools where their kids would learn to read. And that worked. And then when they are disfranchised, and depending on the state, it's 10 years later or 20 years later, and African Americans lose the right to vote in the South, one of the things which happens immediately in the wake of that is the removal of funds for schools for African American children. So the voting rights are both a barometer, but they're also something of a, they can be a cause and effect. But all that said, I mean, I don't want to be suggesting that voting rights answer that having equal voting rights would be an answer to the question of equality. I mean,
right.
At this point in U.S. history, we have substantial, not full, and there are obstacles, but substantial equality in terms of voting rights and political rights, and that certainly hasn't been adequate to address other dimensions of inequality.
We are discussing equality this morning on the Roundtable. It's part of our series, Will We Ever Learn? The Struggle for Equality, One Group at a Time. So, Paul Finkelman, when you look at this, how else can we measure equality? What are the other barometers?
Well, I want to add one thing to the
Sure.
political context, which is that the U.S. Constitution creates a political system which is structurally unequal. We have something called the Senate. The Senate says that each state gets two senators no matter how big the state. So you have the state of Alaska, where you could fit the entire population of the state of Alaska into Staten Island and have a few thousand people left over. And yet Alaska has as many senators as the entire state of New York. There's something structurally unequal about that. When you attach issues of race to that, you get some very strange results, because in fact many of the small states which are disproportionately represented in the Senate are states that have very, very small minority populations. So in the larger states, which have much larger minority populations, I'm talking about percentage of population, not gross numbers, tend to have larger minority populations. That's one piece of it. The other is the Electoral College. Now we've just seen the president elected with the Electoral College. This is the creature from the Black Lagoon that arises every 4 years to scare us, because we may end up with a, quote, democratic election where the person who wins the most votes doesn't get elected president. Why do we have the Electoral College? At the Constitutional Convention, James Madison says the best thing would be if the people elected the president. And then he turns around and says, but we can't do that because of the difference in the franchise. That is a difference in the way the states allowed people to vote, because in some places like Massachusetts, you had a universal adult male suffrage, and in other places like South Carolina, you had a very restricted suffrage. But then he said the more important reason is that our slaves won't count. That is, Virginia, which is the largest state, would only be the third largest state if you don't add the slave population in. And so Madison comes up with the Electoral College, which essentially folds counting slaves for representation, but not for, obviously, voting. And so to this day, we have this very, very weird political system where large numbers of states get electoral votes based on very small populations, because again, you get the two senators thrown in there. And so we have a structure that politically favors one group of people in the United States over another group of people, and this happens election after election after election. You see this in the Senate, particularly to this day. So that's one issue. In terms of other kinds of equality, again, the opportunity to take advantage of equality is very, very different in places depending on economics, depending on race. And there are, of course, high correlations between poverty and race in the United States. When a state requires a voter ID card and says, well, the voter ID card will be based on driver's licenses, that's a discriminatory system because, of course, lots of people don't have voter IDs, particularly people in cities, because they don't need driver's licenses because they don't drive. So, you know, we see this sort of built in across the country. And when Professor Kasar says that the dirty secret is that some people don't want others to vote, you need only look at the impediments thrown up in the last election over and over again in a number of states to suppress voters by having onerous registration requirements or voter IDs, even though there's no evidence that there's any kind of widespread voter fraud, or in one state cutting down early voting. Again, think of an election that we have that only takes place on a Tuesday, and usually only during the morning hours through the early evening hours. So the people who work on an hourly salary, people who collect an hourly wage, they have to take time off from work. They have to lose money to go vote. Whereas people who are on a non-hourly salary, who get a regular salary, people like the three of us, we don't work on an hourly wage. We can simply say, I'm taking an hour off to go vote. We're not going to lose an hour's pay for doing that.
Right.
Add to that ridiculously long lines so that in Florida people were waiting 8 hours to vote. And what you have is somebody is told, you can either get a day's pay or you can vote. You can't do both. That's a distinctly unequal political system, and it's a political system that favors wealth. It favors a certain class of people in terms of jobs. It favors people who live in certain neighborhoods where the voting lines are shorter. All of this stuff multiplies over and over again.
Well, if I can just come in on that for a second, in recent weeks or months, really talking about the election, one of the questions I'm asked regularly is, well, why don't we have elections on a holiday? For example, Veterans Day, which is what was proposed by the Carter Ford Commission in 2001, or why don't we have elections on a weekend? And you know, there's almost something charmingly innocent about that, because behind that question, which I'm asked very frequently, is the presumption that the political elites and political parties of this country really want to increase participation.
Mm.
And I think, and it goes back to the comment that I made to you, I'm not sure that they really do. I don't think that making democracy as vibrant and increasing rates of engagement really is the goal of our political parties.
And by the way, there are some party structural issues. If you listen to any of the commentary at any election, the election commentary is always the same. If there's low voter turnout, Republicans win. If there's higher voter turnout, Democrats win. And this is because many Democratic voters are much more likely to be hourly wage people. They are less likely to be able to take off work. And so this is not I'm not making a partisan comment here. I'm talking about the base of of our two major political parties. And all of the political science literature points out that depending on the voter turnout, you can predict the outcome of an election. If the lines are really long, if there's really big voter turnout, Democrats are far more likely to win. And that's just that, of course, will lead to a Republican legislature in some state trying to create impediments for voting, and then a Democratic-controlled legislature trying to open up the voting even more.
You're listening to a special edition of the Roundtable, part one of our project, Will We Ever Learn? The Struggle for Equality, One Group at a Time. Partial support for this project comes from Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Alexander Kasar is the Matthew Sterling Jr. Professor of History and Social Policy at Harvard University. Paul Finkelman is the John Hope Franklin Visiting Professor of American Legal History at Duke University. We welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. We'll include your thoughts and more conversation after this short break. Welcome back to the Equality Project. We have lines open for you, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. Professor Alexander Kasar of Harvard and Paul Finkelman of Duke University and Albany Law join us this morning as our guests. Paul, I wanted to ask you real quick before we go to the calls and then get into another issue before before we start going through the lines here. You said you wanted to avoid making a partisan statement, and I hesitate to do this, but I do want to ask when, and this is really for both of you, I guess, but when we hear ABC News reported that Mitt Romney said in a conference call with his donors this week that the reason President Obama defeated him for president is that the president gave government-funded gifts to minorities, women, and young people to buy their votes.
All I can say is Mitt Romney, who in some ways is obviously a very smart guy and a hardworking man and a very patriotic American, has been wrong on almost every issue that he stated or talked about during this election. What I find astounding about Mitt Romney is that he made his fortune in Bain Capital by being a numbers guy, by understanding how to crunch numbers, by understanding how to read trends, and his campaign was so completely wrong on their numbers that they didn't even prepare for the slight possibility that they might lose the election, and they simply were blindsided by the fact that 3% more of the American population voted against Romney than voted for him, and so he's now trying to sort this out. I think Romney's statement is kind of pathetic and sad. I think it's the function of somebody who is so disappointed because he believed his own propaganda that he was going to win so big that he's simply reaching out for some reason to explain to those people who literally gave hundreds of millions of dollars why they lost. One could, of course, make the exact same argument if Romney had won. One could say Romney won because upper-class people voted in extraordinary large numbers because Romney promised them huge tax cuts and promised to save them lots of money, and that people who will profit from not having a universal health care system won because Romney promised to destroy a national health care system and therefore give more profits to private hospitals or insurance companies or drug companies. One could say that Romney won because Romney promised to open up vast areas for oil exploration regardless of what it would do to the environment, and therefore every person who thought they might have a job in an oil company or every person who had invested in oil stocks voted for Romney. I mean, you can make that kind of simplistic and I think rather stupid economic analysis across the board. I'll offer one other option for Romney. The exit poll showed that 49% of the people who considered themselves to be straight voted for Romney, and 45% of the people who considered themselves straight voted for Obama. But something like 77% of the people who are gay or lesbians in this country voted for Obama. So maybe what Romney ought to do is say, well, gee, Obama bribed all the gay people by supporting their right to marry people that they're in love with. And maybe if Obama had been against the idea of love and marriage that I would have won, or alternatively, maybe if Romney had come out and said, you know, I don't care who you love as long as it's a good marriage and a happy marriage because I believe in family values. Maybe if Romney had changed his notion of what a family is like, he might have won the election. We can, you know, find lots of reasons. The fact that 59%... I think it was 59% of the women in the country, maybe 57, voted for him. Did Obama bribe the majority of women to vote for Romney, or to Obama? I mean, you know, we just, you know, keep going on and on and on like this.
If I can come in on a slightly different angle on this, and then I know you want to go to callers, but I found in that quote that you read, which I had read earlier, I think that there is also, this is another dimension of inequality there, which is the condescension.
Right.
He would not have used language like goodies or buying votes if, in the examples that Paul gave, you were talking about making gestures or adopting programs to satisfy upper-class constituents. But somehow,
defense contractors, for example. Oh, we're giving goodies for defense contractors.
Right, but somehow buying votes goodies is the traditional language of condescension and even contempt that upper-class folks often express towards poor people and people of color. And it seems to me that with that post-election interview, he basically was telling the American electorate that the image of himself that he had conveyed in the 47% tape was in fact accurate, and that is who he is.
We would love to hear from you, 1-800-348-2551. This is part one of our project, Will We Ever Learn? The Struggle for Equality, One Group at a Time. Alexander Kasar and Paul Finkelman are our guests. We welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551. We'll get right to the phone calls after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable's special Equality Project, Will We Ever Learn? Partial support for the project comes from Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Alexander Kasar and Paul Finkelman are our guests. We go to the phones, and they are loaded. 1-800-348-2551 is the number when, as we start going through calls, that will be your opportunity to get into the conversation. We begin with Gary in Alford, Massachusetts. Gary, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Yesterday, I served on a jury concerned a 27-year-old who was on trial on an indictment to declare him a career criminal. And for, you know, since he was 20, he was into serious drug sales and just a couple weeks ago, firearms. In any case, I mean, it was a very sad situation. A young man whose life was looking forward to, years in prison. You know, he made some wrong choices there, but I wanted to get your guests' comments on how the difference in equality relates to crime and poverty and how it leads to crime. This guy had a 2-year-old son, and after the jury, we made our decision to convict him. The judge came and talked to us, and he said, you know, we were all concerned. It was very emotional for the jurors. And he said, yeah, I see this over and over. You know, what's going to happen to his kids, some of the jurors said. And the judge said, yes, I hear, you know, the kids suffer. So it seems like a repetitive kind of process. And I'd love to hear their comments.
It's a great point, Gary. Thank you very much for the telephone call. Paul, why don't we begin with you?
Well, it's obviously a repetitive process. I mean, the circumstances that lead people to break the law are often the circumstances of their birth and where they live. But at the same time, and this is something that I think goes back to the last comments about, you know, Mitt Romney's perception of the 47%, is that obviously not all or most poor people are criminals. Most minorities don't break the law. But there is this perception that somehow if you're poor, if you're black, if you're brown, if you're from certain neighborhoods, you must inherently be a criminal. And that's simply not the case. And on the other side of it, of course, there are people like Bernie Madoff, who had all the advantages going for him, who was a very, very wealthy man and decided to be a career criminal and will spend the rest of his life behind bars for it. I think one of the things that the United States does not do a very good job of is helping people who start out committing crimes to not do them in the future. We don't do a very good job of training people in prison. We don't do a very good job of schooling young kids who make mistakes when they're children. The other thing we don't do a good job at all is understanding that the scientists tell us that the brain is not fully formed until you're about 24 or 25 years old. Mm-hmm. And so that part of the brain which tells you to behave, to restrain yourself, to not do stupid things, is apparently the last part of the brain to fully mature. So what we do is we take people who do really stupid and sometimes criminal things when they're 16 and 17, and when their brains are not really mature enough for them to behave properly, and we condemn them for the rest of their lives because they now have a criminal record. They now can't do certain things. And that has a huge multiplier effect down the road. So one thing the United States might do is to really rethink how we deal with young lawbreakers, how we deal with people who are incarcerated, what do we teach them, what do we train them. New York State, for example, at the Coxsackie prison, has some fabulous job training for people who are in prison for very long periods of time, but some of them get out and get very, very good jobs because in Coxsackie they're training them, among other things, to do asbestos abatement, which is not a pleasant job, but it's an important one. And people don't ask questions when they're on a construction site, oh, were you in jail that you learned this? So perhaps if we did that kind of job training, not merely with asbestos abatement, but with lots of things, at a much lower level of the prison system, because Coxsackie is a maximum security prison, we would be, you know, going a long way to breaking cycles that connect poverty to crime. The other piece of that, of course, has to do with policing, because we also know that if you're a middle-class person, and particularly if you're not a minority, you are much less likely to go to jail for a minor offense. You're much less likely to get arrested for a minor offense than you are if you're a minority. And the statistics on this are overwhelming. Many police departments have done very, very good jobs at changing this pattern, but it's not a pattern that has been changed universally. And when you read stories about what my African-American friends call the crime of driving while black, where there are African-Americans who are professionals, dentists, doctors, lawyers, driving a nice car with a suit, and they get persistently stopped by cops, you know, basically saying, why are you driving such a nice car? Who are you? You know, that doesn't happen to white people. So there's lots of inputs that lead to crime, but again, all crime isn't racial by any means. You know, there are more white people in jail in this country than non-white people.
Alexander Kaysar.
Well, just a short comment, taking this directly back to the question of inequality. I mean, we are a very strange society in a way. I mean, we have extremely high levels of economic inequality. We also have the largest prison population in the world, and that's something which I think doesn't register with a large proportion of the population. It's we have an enormous prison population, and we are spending what often strikes me as a disturbing amount of money building prisons. I mean, I used to live in North Carolina, where Paul is right now, and you know, one of the frequently commented upon features of the social landscape, that if you go to city in North Carolina, and you try to find the largest, most modern public building, it was invariably the prison, never one of the schools.
Mm.
There's something wrong with that picture.
Just to follow up on that, we also have, of course, a gigantic industry that relies on increased criminalization of things, so that there are many things that people go to jail for in this country that in other countries it would be a fine or it would be some other punishment, but it would not be prison. The huge numbers of people who are incarcerated for very small drug offenses, for example, and that tends to be overwhelmingly poor people, overwhelmingly minorities, and also, of course, overwhelmingly people under 25, who are then stamped for the rest of their lives and can't get on with their lives because they have this record that, yeah, I got picked up for pot when I was 18, and now I can't get a job. You know, and then you look at things like the student loan process, where if you have certain kinds of criminal records, you can't get a student loan, so you can't get ahead and get an education and change your life. You know, the fact that we have more people in prison than China, which is, of course, you know, more than three times the size of the United States and is a repressive totalitarian country, is pretty scary.
We welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551. One more call before we go to another quick break. John is in Dalton, Massachusetts. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just commenting on, you know, the voting rights and what you're talking about is all good. But I think one of the major things you need to understand, too, is the media and misleading people en masse. And it's almost become, I don't know if it's idiocy or ignorance, but it's very disturbing the way that people take what's said on TV or through the internet as gospel, when indeed a lot of the things are just, you know, the assumptions people make on whether it be the environment or energy policy or foreign relations. And the game that it's been made of, it's almost become like a reality TV thing regarding politics and important issues that, you know, we're facing.
So, Alexander Kasar, what role does the media have specifically in creating the inequality or the image of inequality that we feel and see?
Well, there may be multiple roles here, but I think one serious issue is the way in which the media detracts in covering, say, political campaigns, detracts attention or distracts us from focusing on serious, difficult issues. It tends to see election campaigns as horse races, or as part of, as the caller said, it's really as some part of celebratory culture. And you know, we face a lot of serious issues that having to do with inequality, and we're not getting a lot of help. Now, maybe that's too much to ask of the media. I don't know. I mean, there, you know, some people would respond to that by saying, well, you know, there are serious shows on television and on radio, but a lot of people don't listen to them. Or, okay, well, if people want to listen to issues, they can listen to NPR. So perhaps it's unfair, but I certainly found myself, you know, very disturbed by reading things like, for example, if you look at over the last year at the network news, the amount of time that was spent covering international affairs and foreign policy compared to the amount of time on celebrity stories is really appalling. There's much more time, even on the national news, on celebrity stories.
We are going to go to a quick break, and we'll be back and continue our conversation. You're listening to Will We Ever Learn? The Struggle for Equality, One Group at a Time. Alexander Kasar and Paul Finkelman are our guests. We welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551. We'll continue with those phone calls and continue our conversation after this short break. If you're just joining us, this is a special edition of the Roundtable, part one of our project, Will We Ever Learn the Struggle for Equality One Group at a Time? Part two will be presented on Monday morning from 9 to 10. Part three presented on Tuesday morning from 9 to 10. Partial support for the project comes from Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Alexander Kasar is the Matthew Sterling Junior Professor of History and Social Policy at Harvard University. Paul Finkelman is the John Hope Franklin Visiting Professor of American Legal History at Duke University. And we welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551. Paul Finkelman, real quick before we go back to the phones, a subject that I wanted to talk about in when we discuss equality, the term diversity obviously is often used interchangeably, but a very different term, isn't it?
Yeah, because diversity implies that you have many, many views, many, many different kinds of people, many different things. And diversity in itself, I think, becomes a useful end. A few years ago, there was a lawsuit over whether or not to allow affirmative action at the University of Michigan. And part of the affirmative action program at Michigan was upheld by the Supreme Court in a close vote with, among others, Justice O'Connor being in the majority. And Justice O'Connor's majority opinion focused on what's called an amicus brief, which is a friend of the court. It wasn't actually parties, but people who were interested. And the amicus brief that she focused on was offered on behalf of about 20 former very high-ranking military officers, four-star generals and admirals, all of whom said, we cannot run the military in the United States unless we have a sufficient number of minority officers. And they argued that the only way you're going to get minority officers in is if you have an affirmative action program, a program that affirmatively looks for certain kinds of people. That diversity is necessary to run the military. And this is not about, in a sense, from the military perspective, this wasn't not about kind of social justice. They were simply saying, you know, we can't run an army if we have almost only white officers and a very mixed bag of troops that represent, you know, really the full face of America. Another example of this is that in recent years, we have obviously been involved in wars against terrorism and other kinds of conflicts in the Middle East. Having native Arabic speakers is essential to our national defense, to our national security. One aspect of diversity would be to affirmatively seek out children of immigrants or immigrants themselves who are native Arab speakers, Arabic speakers, and bring them into universities because we need those people to be integrated in our society. So diversity, you know, has a variety of meanings. In terms of universities, where both Alex and I teach, and normally, of course, I teach at Albany Law School, you know, we live in a world where we have a diverse world. Our students need to learn how to get along with other people. They need to learn how to go to school with people who don't look like them, because that's what the workforce is going to be.
We want to go back to the phones and go to Helen in South Egremont, Massachusetts. Helen, good morning. Welcome to the conversation.
Good morning. Thank you very much. First, I want to say that this is an absolutely spectacular program. It's phenomenally interesting, and I am thankful that you are airing it.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. My point is about inequality in education, and probably because of the poverty of the town or city in which the schools are. A friend of mine was volunteering, this was in the 80s, in Chelsea, Massachusetts, to teach cooking. She's a phenomenal cook, a lawyer, and what she found is that the children, some of who were Vietnamese boat children, had memorized the information, but they had no idea what it meant. And so she would ask them the questions, but their teachers never asked them, what does it mean? All you have to do is know the answer. So it's like, okay, is it true or false? What is the date? You know, this kind of education. And it's, in many respects, it's meaningless because it doesn't lead to anything. It doesn't teach anyone how to think and evaluate. And so I was looking for comments on this. What her comment for what she was doing was that she was Jewish mothering these children.
Mm. I mean, if I can offer, you know, a couple of comments about this. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that that our education system, in many respects, is replicating and reinforcing the inequalities that exist in society today. I mean, part of what has happened is that parts of the upper middle classes have abandoned the public education system altogether and send their kids to private schools. Other people move to essentially class segregated suburbs, which to communities that are not at all like Chelsea, Massachusetts, which is not far from where I'm sitting right now. And the challenges of teaching in a poor community where the kids are not very well prepared for school and where the resources are not terrific and class size is often too large, those are very serious challenges that we are not really facing as a society. I mean, again, I mentioned earlier the fact that, you know, we stand out on the indicator of number of people in prison in the United States. Our performance on standardized educational tests compared to other industrial societies is also quite low. This is a serious issue. And the other just small comment to make is that there's abundant evidence now of various sorts that investing early in a child's life, early childhood education, I mean, even before K-12, but certainly, you know, but up to the age of 10 for a child has a very significant impact on that child's life chances. And the kind of investment, the quantity of investment that's going into each child is class correlated right now. And the outcomes are class correlated.
Let me offer a couple of other examples of precisely this problem. We all know that standardized tests matter a great deal in terms of where you go to college, whether you go to college, where you go to graduate school, where you go to professional school.
Right.
We also know that the more often you take standardized tests, the better you are at them. If you're able to take preparation courses, it can help you a great deal. These tests are very expensive. So a wealthy school district is able to give standardized tests every year, maybe more than once a year. A poor school district may give them once every 4 or 5 years. The result is that that students who have the exact same gray matter ability, you know, if we could measure that, we'll do very differently on the tests depending on whether or not they can afford to take the tests, the school districts. Same thing for something like the SAT. The SAT now allows you to take the test over and over again and only report your highest scores. That means that children whose parents have more resources are able to say, yes, take the test 4 times, and, you know, see if you can better your score by a few points each time. Children who have to scrape the money together to take it once can't do that. Now, there are some scholarships for students. You know, if you're really, really poor, you may not have to pay for these tests, but that's an onerous burden in itself. So these are, you know, certain kinds of examples. The other thing is in the political context. You see politicians complaining about teacher salaries. You see politicians complaining about the high cost of education. But these are the very same people often who in a different context would say, we want to hire the best people and we pay our executives the most money because we want to get the best people. You know, Mitt Romney, I'm sure, does not skimp on salaries at Bain Capital because he wants to get these, believes in the marketplace, he believes in a competitive world for getting the best people, but suddenly when it comes to educational policy, we don't believe in the competitive policies. We don't think we should be going after the best people. We want to, in fact, nickel and dime public school teachers all over the country.
Helen, thank you very much for the telephone call. This has been a special edition of the Roundtable, part one of our project, Will We Ever Learn? The Struggle for Equality, One Group at a Time. Our guests have been Alexander Kasar, Matthew Sterling, Junior Professor of History and Social Policy at Harvard University. Paul Finkelman is the John Hope Franklin Visiting Professor of American Legal History at Duke University, and the President William McKinley Distinguished Professor at Law and Public Policy and Senior Fellow at the Government Law Center at Albany Law. Gentlemen, it's been a great pleasure to share this time with you, and I thank you very much for discussing these serious issues with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Partial support for the project comes from Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The Mass Humanities grant is part of their initiative, Crisis, Community, and Civic Culture. Will We Ever Learn? We'll continue on Monday with a discussion on disenfranchisement. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.